We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The zombie apocalypse is imminent. Could you survive? You'll have a better chance after completing Geek Nation Tours Zombie Apocalypse Training 101. Learn to fire weapons, scrounge for food, and actually run from zombies. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
Hey, Owen, here we go. Welcome to a We Talk Comics extra special edition. I'm Brett. I've got Mo here, my co-conspirator.
Yeah, let's call it that.
And today we are welcoming the writer of Amazing Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, Spider-Girl, Thor, Thunderstrike, former editor-in-chief of Marvel, the legendary Tom DeFalco. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for adding in the legendary. It just lets everybody know that I'm old and can't get work anymore.
Oh, come on.
Let's say iconic. Let's say the iconic.
No. The legendary is fine.
Okay.
The legendary is fine. Whenever Ron Frenz uses that, I know he's busting my chops. So.
I listened to an interview or two with you and Ron Frenz together, and he seems like a great guy. He's got a hell of a sense of humor.
He does. Sadly, he has all the personality in the team and most of the talent. I've been riding on his coattails for many a year and hope to continue to exploit the hell out of him.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand. Brett does that with me.
Because you work with Ron a lot. And actually, it's funny because when I was talking with Brett Breeding at the Edmonton show as well, which is where I first met you, Brett was saying that Ron is one of his absolute favorite people to work with as well. So what is it about Ron that everybody loves?
Well,
unless you don't love him.
I can crack all the jokes I want, Ron is one of the sweetest, nicest guys you're ever going to meet in your life. He's a wonderful, warm human being, and he is so immensely talented that we all want to strangle him because he makes the rest of us all look like bums. He is, I think, probably the best visual storyteller of his generation. He can draw, anything. A couple of weeks ago, I was giving a little talk about, how comic books are made and that sort of stuff. And I had, all sorts of different samples. I had an Archie comic page, a superhero page, very dramatic, romance page, a number of different pages. And then, later on, I mentioned to the audience that all of them were drawn by the same person, Ron Frenz. And that stunned most of the people there, especially the artists. They just could not believe the range that Ron has. And when he does an Archie page, it just looks like a perfect Archie page. You don't see Ron Frenz there. I mean, I see Ron Frenz, but you guys, the odds that you just look and say, wow, that's just an Archie page. A well-drawn Archie.
Yeah, I just read one of the Archie comics that you wrote with Ron drawing, and I was surprised by how absolutely dead-on Archie it is.
It's amazing to me, Ron was constantly striving to do a better Archie. And just around the time when he stopped doing the Archie, he thought he had just had it. He said, I think I can finally draw Archie right. And I said, well, that's good for you, Ron, but Archie thinks you've been drawing Archie right, you know, from the first, from your first attempt. He's just an amazing guy.
That's one of the, that's interesting, because I think the perception from the readers would be Archie isn't that hard to draw. And maybe, you know, maybe we're wrong.
The readers are definitely wrong. With Archie, because there are so few lines in the artwork, there is no margin for error. You're off just the slightest bit, and it looks terrible. I mean, there is, you know, with superhero stuff, you can hide a lot of mistakes, and you can do all sorts of foreshortening. And it, you know, if you can't draw feet or you can't draw hands, you can try to hide that a lot. And you'll notice that with a lot of art samples, you know, people are often cut off at the knees because the artist doesn't know how to draw legs or draw a fist or that sort of stuff. With Archie, because it's a lot of full figure work, a lot of facial expressions, you cannot make the slightest bit of an error.
Easy to make a Rob Liefeld joke there, but I won't.
Now,
Rob is a good guy, another friend of mine, so be careful.
Like I said, it would be easy, but I won't.
So now you talk about that from an artist's perspective. Now, what about writing Archie? I mean, you've written Archie a lot. And so is there, you know, I mean, you've done a lot of, especially recently, you've done a lot of the specialized stories, you know, like Archie as Robin Hood and the like. Are those just kind of things that you come up with and then pitch to them? Do they ask you about those, or do you have pretty much carte blanche to do whatever you kind of like?
Well, you know, it all depends. Like with any publisher, I think, you know, I wrote the last Archie story that appeared in, you know, before they switched over to the Mark Wade kind of Archie stuff. And, there they had some very definite ideas on what they wanted to see in the story. So we discussed it, and most of their ideas were terrific. So, you know, I went with a lot of them. You know, most of the time what they do is they, you know, they call me up and they say, we need a 12-page story that's going to appear during the winter time. You know, not near Christmas, so it shouldn't be reflective of Christmas. And, you know, we'd like to see some slapstick. What do you got? And, you know, my answer is always, I have nothing. but, you know, give me a few hours and I'll come up with something. I'm the kind of writer that I come up with story ideas as I need them. I've run into people that said, oh, I have this one Captain America story that I've been waiting all my life to tell. Yeah, I don't have that. I have no Batman stories that I've been waiting to tell or anything else like that. You know, if someday somebody calls me up and says, hey, we'd like you to do a Batman story, you have any ideas? I'd say, not right now, but when do you need the ideas? And, you know, and that's when I'll have some. And then I'll just get myself into a Batman frame of mind, and then things will flow. And that happens with whatever character I'm dealing with. Archie, Spider-Man, you know, Spider-Girl, you name it. That's how I do it. You know, especially when I'm doing, you know, one story at a time, as opposed to working on a series.
We had a chance to listen to Larry Hama do a panel one time, and he talked about how when he would finish a G.I. Joe and put it aside, and then when it was time to write the next issue, he'd pick it up and go, what kind of trouble did I get myself into here, and how do I get myself out of it? And he said he never once plotted out like a full year's worth of story, even the next month's worth of stories. So how about you? How far ahead of time would you plot?
Larry is a much more courageous person than I am. When I was working on something like Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man and Spider-Girl, I'd know where I was taking the characters for the next 6 months. I didn't know, you know, and by that I meant their personal lives, their personal subplots, you know, what kind of agony I was going to, you know, drag them through. In terms of, you know, the villain and the soup, you know, and the conflict, a lot of times I was, you know, making that up as I went along. But their personal stories, I knew where that was going. A book like Fantastic Four, which, you know, Fantastic Four sounds like you got just four characters, but I think when I was doing it, I had about 20 or 30. So I was juggling a lot of subplots. That I, you know, again, you know, I knew where every character was going to be for 6 months. It was really a complicated, very complicated, you know, bunch of storylines. And I also try to do, you know, even though I have complicated storylines and subplots, I try to make each comic book a complete unit of entertainment with a beginning, middle, and end, even if it's part of a two-part story or a four-part story, you know, or I think we did one thing called Nobody Gets Out Alive, which was a six-part story. If you look at it, each of those parts, all of them have a beginning, middle, and end, and then another cliffhanger that just drags into the next issue, because, you know, I always want you to buy the next issue, too.
Well, one of the things that always struck me about reading your work is that you managed to maintain, and perhaps it is because of your planning the personal lives 6 months ahead, you did manage to maintain a really nice feel for the personal lives of the characters and just, you know, actually tell them in a human way, whereas so many other writers that I have read, you know, they just tend towards the action, whereas you really tend towards human stories.
Well, I think that's what, you know, to me, writing, especially, you know, fiction writing, is all about trying to make sense or make the human condition seem like it makes sense. You know, in real life, weird things happen, and, you know, with or without meaning. A friend of yours could, you know, could get sick or hit by a car, or, you know, tragedy could befall you in a million different ways. And you look at it and you try to figure out what the greater meaning is. And the truth is, if there is a greater meaning, you're never going to figure it out. But in fiction, everything has meaning, and everything is supposed to fit together. You know, every little nuance, every little line of dialogue, it all supposed to fit into a coherent whole. And that has always been the draw of fiction to me, because, you know, in fiction, everything makes sense, where sometimes in life, sadly, nothing makes sense.
One of the things I've always really appreciated about your writing is that it's not just the heroes and their supporting cast that gets dignity. I think the villains get their level of dignity too. They're not. I think so many times people use some villain and they almost use them to set up the hero for another villain, and he's not given his own moment. Whereas when, you know, it's when I'm reading your work, I feel like the villain is fully developed as well as the hero.
Well, I do appreciate that, because to me, you know, all writing is about character. And each character really has to be a character. They really have to be a person, you know, living, breathing, bleeding person. And that's your heroes, your villains, the people who just walk past in a scene, here and there. You try as much as you can to make each person, you know, seem as important as they really are in real life. You know, when you walk down a city street, you're surrounded by, in Manhattan, you're surrounded by hundreds of people. And most of them are, you know, they're barely faces. But in reality, each of them are each of them is the star of their own story, their own drama, and the central part of someone's life. And like I say, in fiction, you know, you have a story with, you know, a comic book story, maybe you got 10, 20, 50, you know, 25 characters in the course of that. Every one of them, you know, you've got to make the reader feel for every one of them. And that includes the villains. You know, I love the soap opera part of writing, whether it's in comic books or prose or television or whatever the heck it is, because, you know, I want you to feel for the characters. I want you to feel for the villains. I don't think anybody ever intends to be a villain. You know, I always look at Dr. Doom. Now, here's a man who, you know, he wants to bring about world peace. He wants to end human suffering. He wants to end hunger and crime. And he only asks for one small thing in exchange. Total blind obedience. Now, from his point of view, that's very reasonable. Think of it. There'd be no more war if everybody just listened to Doom. You know? Well, the peasants will be happy because he has ordered them to be so. So, you know, he doesn't see himself as a villain. He sees himself as the savior of the world. And, you know, you've got to take things from the villain's perspective. And you got to take, you know, every character in the story. You've got to really peer into their souls and see what they really want, what they really like. I think that, you know, I read, you know, occasional comic books where it seems to me that the writer is treating the comic book almost as a video game, where, you know, the characters just are going through motions, and, you know, a problem is coming up and character solves it. Problem comes up, character solves it. You know, to me, I like, you know, problem comes up and the character scratches his head, comes up with a solution, which doesn't work, and then he's got to come up with something else. You know? And also we need, you know, the quiet moments with the characters. You know, one of the things I noticed about the early days of Spider-Man, on any given issue, it was 60-40. 60% Peter Parker, 40% Spider-Man, 60% Spider-Man, 40% Peter Parker. You'd move it around. These days, a lot of people in costume only talk to other people in costume. You know? I want these people to be people. I don't want them just to be, you know, masks.
No, I think that's a great way to put it. It's so important because when I read the current comic books, I think the plots the writers are coming up with are better than ever, like just intricate. So many parts, it's brilliant, and their characterizations with their dialogue are really good. The dialogue itself is terrific, and yet somehow I feel like they don't necessarily always understand the reader experience. And so something seems almost to be missing to me compared to, I mean, and the language of comics has changed. The way you wrote a comic in the 70s was different than, you know, in the early 90s, which is different than today. You know, Joe Hill is completely different, you know, written in a completely different way than something like, you know, What If would have been back in the 70s. But yeah, I don't know that the current writers, as great as they are, I feel like they sometimes don't understand the reader experience, and so it comes across as a short book where I don't necessarily know everything that's going on, even though they do.
Yeah, I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, the craft is so highly polished that it lacks passion. And, you know, I want, you know, to me, comic books are passion. You know, people often confuse comics with film. And they write full scripts as if they're writing, you know, for film. But we're more like theater or opera, you know, grand gestures, big emotions, you know, let's burst into tears. You know, let's have big, exciting, you know, passion. You know, and I think sometimes, you know, guys, when they write this stuff, they think, oh man, these are heroes in costumes. It's ridiculous. Well, yeah, it is ridiculous. But you know, it's our job when we're doing this sort of stuff is to burrow deeply into the psyche of these ridiculous, goofy characters and make them real. Make them real for us. And if we make them real for us, we will make them real for you. And I think that's what we're being paid to do. So that's what I've always tried to do. And I still try to do it. I mean, I take every story, you know, deadly serious, whether it's a Spider Girl story where she's dealing with the loss of her dad, or it's an Archie story where he's caught between, you know, a gorgeous blonde and a gorgeous brunette, and he doesn't know what's going to happen to him today.
Do you think that a lot of the newer writers tend towards writing with trade paperbacks in mind, as opposed to just writing coherent long-term storylines?
That's what everybody says, and I think to a certain extent, you know, a number of writers think that way. I think a number of readers think that way. I remember reading a review of a new title. And the review looked and said, well, we don't really know what's going on yet. We don't understand the character's powers. We don't understand that. This, we don't understand that. But it's only the third issue, so. You know, and to me, what? I probably shouldn't share this story. But I remember, you know, a million years ago when I was, doing mysteries and that sort of stuff. And my editor looked at me and he said, kid, you got 5 pages to show me a dead body. And if I don't have a dead body by page 5, I ain't going to page 6 and neither are you. And, I always thought, you know, he's right. And that's for, you know, 350 page novel. You got 5 pages to establish that dead body. And I still believe that here it is years later. Because you need to start your story off and you need to grip the readers. And I think sometimes you read 6 issues and you still haven't seen your quote unquote dead body. I've seen trade paperbacks that to me start in the middle of a story and end in the middle of a story. And I'm sorry, trade paperback should be a complete unit of entertainment. It should start at the beginning, give you a middle, and, you know, give you an explosive. I always say explosive, but give you an end that really, you know, shatters the world that you were dealing with. Passion. Come on, guys. These are comic books. Let's have a great time. Let's get involved.
Yeah, I was reading a book recently, and yeah, it had a bunch of characters in it, and they would have somebody mention somebody's first name, and then like 2 pages later, I would go, "Oh, it's that character. That's who that was," you know. Or they would do something, use a power, but not really. Just kind of in one panel, and then I'd be left trying to figure out who it was based on that. And like I say, there's a language and there's a reader experience, it sounds to me like that's one thing that you're always very aware of, is the reader experience.
Well, yeah, because I read comic books. I still read comic books. Comic books, comic strips, all of that stuff. I love the medium.
Sorry, we're gonna. Who is that, Brett? And why the hell are they calling you when Tom DeFalco's on the air?
Don't ask me.
We're gonna just let
somebody, if it's somebody that I owe money to, tell him I just got off.
If he's looking for Tom,
yeah. Oh, how did you know that Tom was online right now?
I'm sorry, Tom. Could you start that again? If you remember what it was.
I was just saying, I value the reader experience because, I am a reader. I read a ton of, over the course of my life, I have read more comic books than you guys could possibly imagine. More comic strips and never enough novels. I still read at least, these days I've slowed down, but I've pretty much slowed down with about everything. And I'm probably only reading a book a week at this stage of the game. But I'm a voracious reader. I love reading, and I enjoy the experience of being a reader. So as a writer, I value my readers. I think it is a great privilege to be a writer because, you're taking two very valuable things from your readers. You're costing them money, obviously, because they're buying your work. And you're also, costing them time. Now, the money they can get back because you can always earn more money, but you can never get time back. So it's very important that you, as a writer, are worth your reader's time. So I try to make sure, whether it's a 5-page story or a 20-page story or a 350-page story, that I am worth that every moment they're spending with me, because you guys are never going to get that time back. And I don't want you to finish it, finish anything I've written and look at it and go, boy, that was a waste of time. Because
so this obviously is, this approach, how did that serve you well as a editor-in-chief of Marvel as well?
I just, tried to instill that, into my guys, that it is an honor and a privilege that we'd be welcome into anybody's house. So never take the comic books that you're producing on any level for granted. And, as a writer, I have no hesitation about rewriting a line 20, 30 times until I get it right. And then I turn, then once I turn it over to an editor, I try never to look at it again. I used to tell the guys, whatever effort it takes you to get this comic book to the way that you think it should be done, go to that effort, go to that wall, make it the best possible comic book you can do in the time that you have, and then get it out the door, and then turn all of your attention and all of your focus on the next one.
So if we can go back to a couple of my favorite issues that you ever wrote, I guess one of them you didn't write, you plotted it. Stan Lee wrote it. It was Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 18 with Scorpion and the JJ's wedding. So I'm just kind of wondering, how did that come about that you ended up plotting and he ended up, because that was the first time in 10 years, I guess, that he had done the dialogue. And I love it because, the Scorpion is a character, I just think he's treated so well in that story. He's one of my favorite Spider-Man villains.
I've always had a soft spot for the Scorpion. I don't remember all of the details. I just know that at a certain point while I was working at Marvel, because we had so many things going on, I was assigned to deal with Stan Lee. And Stan and I got to talking, and Stan and I got along, very well. I used to say one of my job benefits is I get to talk to Stan Lee. Stan and I got along very well, and he was very busy with the West Coast stuff, the animation business at that time. And I, would often talk to him and say, Stan, any chance you'll ever write any more comic books? I'd love to do it. I'd love to do it, but I really don't have time. I really don't have time because, the plotting takes me forever. And at one point I said to him, hey, how about if I plot a story for you? He goes, I don't know, Tommy. I don't know. I'd have to read the plot to see whether or not, I thought, and I said, you want to read the plot to see if it sucks, right? It says, oh, no, I would never say that to you. And I said, no, you'd never say it to me. You'd say it behind my back. And he goes, all right. And an annual was coming up. And we wanted to do something special. We decided, Jameson had been dating Marla Madison for a while. And, hey, let's let's make this like in a good old-fashioned annual where something big happens. You know, Jonah Jameson gets married. And I called up Stan. I said, you know, we're going to do this story where Jonah Jameson gets married. He goes, why would Jonah Jameson get married? What are you talking? What are you, crazy? He says, I don't think he's even dating. I said, yeah, he's been dating this one woman in the comic books for a couple of years now. Why doesn't anybody ever tell me these things? I said, you know, come on, Stan. So I did the plot, and I sent him a copy of the plot, and he looked at the plot and he said, oh, wow. Says, okay, yeah, all right. I'd love to script this story. He says, but I gotta see what the artwork is like, and you know, when do you need it, and blah 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 blah. And he started talking to Danny Fingerhorpe, who's the editor, and Danny said, you know, we'd like the script in by such and such a date. And Stan said, oh, there's no way I can do it by that time. Can you give me an extra 2 weeks? Danny checks the schedule and they negotiate it. You know, get back to Stan. Sure. We can stretch it out 2 weeks. They send him the first half of the book by Ron Frenz. Stan, you know, calls me up that day. Says, wow, this stuff is great. I love this artwork. I love this guy, Frenz. He's fabulous. He says, but I'm not sure when I can get around to scripting it. I'm gonna, you know. He says, I want to look at the artwork again. You guys still there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
No, we're still here. We're loving this story. This is great. I'm thinking, Ron right? Frenz, he's going to love the artwork.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I said, okay. And she said, I'll get back to you. I'll figure out when I can get around to scripting this thing. I've got a lot of stuff, but I keep looking at this artwork. Okay, Stan, terrific. So, you know, the next day comes, and I don't hear from Stan. I think, oh, you know, and Danny says, I haven't heard from Stan. I said, don't worry about it. He likes the artwork. He's going to check his schedule. He's going to let us know when he can get around to it. All right? And the following day, you know, the first half of the book arrived scripted. Stan had basically looked at the artwork and stayed up all night and did the script and FedExed it out the next morning to us. So we got it the following day. And what would keep happening is, you know, Danny would get the artwork, send it to Stan. Stan would want to know when he needed it. Danny would tell him. Stan would cry and beg for an extra 2 weeks and write it overnight anyway. and I thought Stan did a fabulous job on that. And then, you know, for a while there, anytime anybody wanted Stan to do a story, he would call me up and I would end up, you know, I would do the plot and Stan would do the script. And we did that for, you know, a whole bunch of years.
It's an awesome book. And the two standout moments for me is, number one is the Scorpion using his celebrity to manipulate the security guard to escape prison, because that to me is, well, not even prison. It was, you know, more like a hospital for the mentally insane, that where Jameson, Jonah, was paying for his treatment. Out of guilt for what he had done, and I thought that's great. I mean, there's so many layers there. Jonah is there, and all of a sudden the Scorpion is a smart manipulative villain, and that to me is one of the standout moments. Another one, of course, is when Spidey hears that that Jonah's getting married, and he goes into the Daily Bugle and busts his balls about getting married, and dips him, and even kisses him on the lips, and all this stuff. It is a fabulous book.
You know, well, some of that stuff. At one point, when I was editing Spider-Man, I was talking to Roger Stern, and Roger Stern said to me, whenever I think of Spider-Man, I think of a Warner Brothers cartoon. And I said, what? He said, yeah, for some reason, I think of Spider-Man as Daffy Duck. and that stuck in my head. And you know, and as a result, when I started writing Spider-Man, every once in a while, I do these Daffy Duck moments because I thought, you know, that was the perfect Peter Parker, because Peter Parker probably grew up with watching Daffy Duck.
Now the black costume makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Now. That's right. One of the other issues that you did that's just a favorite of mine, I know Brett probably has his opinions on this, he'll want to say too, is Marvel Team-Up number 86 with The Thing and Sandman, though it's not even a full 24 pages. In some ways, I wonder if this is, to me, I wonder if this is the best thing you ever wrote, because it's just so perfect. I mean, you know, we hear the story of the Sandman, the Thing relates, Ben Grimm relates to him in the backgrounds, and then as he walks away, he gives him a little speech about you have a second chance, and it resonates, and all of a sudden, this villain that had been around forever already, to me, all of a sudden, he wasn't just a bad guy, he was a human being who had made bad choices, and I get very emotional at the end of that story. I think it's just so good, Tom.
Thank you very much. That was a very special story to me. I was surprised when I proposed it, that Marvel accepted it, because it was just kind of an offbeat thing, which I think, you know, to a certain extent, you know, so many of my things were just offbeat things. And it epitomized a lot of what, you know, to me makes a good comic book story. It was all about the characters, and their personal dramas. So thank you very much. I liked that one. I also liked the one where the Thing was in the hospital, and at the end, Sandman shows up with a six pack, and you know, I think a six pack and a roast beef sandwich, so that they could just sit back and, you know, relax together.
And the cover on that one's unbelievable. Yeah. All the heroes kind of stumbling, trying to get into the room over each other. So, yeah, it's great. It was Ron Wilson, wasn't it?
Yeah, Ron Wilson. I loved working on 2-in-1 with Ron Wilson. That was really, you know, that was such a dream experience. I had been writing a couple of books for Marvel, and then they conned me into coming on staff as an editor. And I had to, you know, give up most of my freelance work for the comic books at the time. But the one book I could not give up was, 2-in-1, because I just loved dealing with Ben Grimm so much. You know, Shooter often asked me, you know, hey, what is this, an autobiography here?
Well, I know that Comic Book Resources did a fan vote of your of the fans' favorite work of yours, and so I kind of wondered, like, do you ever go online and look at what people think about your writing and all those comics, or is that just kind of a, you know, wait for the convention moment?
Well, for years when I was on staff and stuff, you know, mainly what I would hear was with the negative comments. I remember at one point somebody said, hey, did you ever check out your Wikipedia page? So I said, I didn't even know I had a Wikipedia page. I checked it out and I thought, man, this was written by the Tom DeFalco Hate Squad. I think it's been changed over the years. You know, most of the time when I would read reviews, they would just, you know, tell me what a bum I was. So, I would, try to stay away from that stuff, because I found it very discouraging. A lot of, during the time when I was writing Fantastic Four, people used to come up to me all the time and said, man, I hate what you're doing. I hate it. You know, I can't stand what you're doing. And I said, well, you know, I'm sorry. You know, Are you gonna stop reading? And they, no, I can't stop. I just gotta see what new horrible thing you're gonna do to the characters. And I said to a couple of readers, well, if you why do you hate it so much? He says, well, because you never give the characters a break. You just keep adding misery on it. You know, can't you do an issue where nothing happens? And I said, yeah, there's plenty of times when nothing happens, but that occurs all between issues. And a lot of people who, hated it then, love it now, because, a couple of people said that, during your time, I really hated what you were doing, but, I haven't really cared about it ever since. And I look back on that. On the one hand, I'm very flattered, but on the other hand, I'm thinking, how could you not care about what's going on? And I sometimes think that, sometimes, the writers and the artists have to, they've got to be more personally invested into what's happening in their books. Because, a lot of times when I would be typing out scenes, there would be tears in my eyes as I'm typing out the scene. Because, I'd be doing a scene that would break my heart. And because I figured if it was breaking my heart, it would, have to affect a couple of readers. And I've talked to people and they say, oh, no, that's unprofessional. Damn you, it's not unprofessional. It's unprofessional not to care about what's going on. If we don't care, how can we make you care? And that's my job, is to make you care. So, I don't know if I blathered on or if I answered your question.
No, your passion is awesome.
And the thing is that I remember reading Fantastic Four when it was coming out, and it was the first book on my collection. Like, there are a few books that I can generally comment and say, like, at a certain period, I thought that was the best comic being produced at the time. And for me, the Fantastic Four that you were writing was the best comic being produced at the time for me, because it was just, I wanted that next issue. I wanted to read what you were going to do with the characters. But I loved the fact that the plot lines were carrying on. And to be honest with you, I was a little concerned about rereading them, because I was worried that, am I going to have the same mindset now as I did back when I was younger and reading these? And I just reread them all, and I couldn't stop.
Good.
It was like 50 issues of Fantastic Four, 50, 60 issues that you wrote in a row. And I just, I just devoured them all in just a couple of weeks. And so, still there, top notch.
Thank you. You made me very happy. You had asked the question, save things for going to conventions. Well, for many years, I didn't go to any conventions. Maybe I'd go to one convention a year. This past year, I think I've gone to like, I don't know, half a dozen, probably a lot more than I've been for years. And that's because these days I consider myself semi-retired, which means I only work 5 days a week. Back in the other, the before semi-retirement period, I used to work pretty well 7 days a week, so I just didn't have time to go to a lot of conventions. These days I suddenly understand why people like weekends so much. Really, wow, this is a terrific thing to just goof around for a day or so. I don't always get to have, both days off, but it's fun to have some time off these days. Mark DeMattis was the guy who said to me, you should go out to some conventions because, you should be reminded that the work, reaches out and touches people, because, you know, sometimes you spend so much time, you know, producing the work and going through the agony of the work that you forget that there are actually people out there who are enjoying it. And I really enjoyed going to conventions this year to really, you know, I was surprised at, you know, the depth of emotion. And I think I've lasted long enough that, hey, I don't suck anymore.
Well, there's a writer friend of ours, and I ran into him at the Edmonton convention, and he was just like, oh, hey, Brett, how's it going? Hold on, I'll talk to you later. Tom's at his table right now. I've really got to get this comic signed.
Well, I was just very thrilled. That Edmonton was a great experience. I got to meet a lot of fans, and I think I started to do my how to write comic seminar for the first time, which I wasn't sure how that would turn out. It seemed to have turned out, you know, pretty good. People seem to like that stuff. I just had a great time. So, you know, I had a really nice time going to conventions this year. I don't know how many I'm going to go to next year, but this year I had a great time.
And I have a question about Fantastic Four, a question about conventions. Now I'm torn. Let's go back to Fantastic Four, because I remember also Brett and I actually shared a file at the time, because comics are a lot of money and we bought a lot of them. And but I remember the same thing. He would read Fantastic Four, pass off to me, I'd read it. It was great. One of the things that I really appreciated about that was, I mean, you make changes to the characters. Like, you know, Thing had his face scarred by Wolverine, and then he had this mask, metal mask type thing on. But one of the things that really always got me was, you apparently killed Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic. And this is in a time when, this is after Superman had been killed and Batman's back had been broken. And you know, there's all this stuff where it seemed like all these events were happening as marketing ploys to some degree, whereas it just kind of happened in the story. And it was hilarious to me because nobody realized, you kept him gone for a long time.
It was like 2.5 years. Yeah.
And nobody realized for months that Reed Richards was dead. And then all of a sudden, the value of that book started going up, and, you know, the collector guide magazines going, Reed Richards died in this book. And I'm going, yes, this happened forever ago, guys. And, you know, so what was the kind of the decision of that, and how was it that, how did you feel the fans kind of reacted, and the kind of the people started to realize it? And also, why was it made a bigger deal of? Why was it something that kind of has happened and you kept going?
Well, I wanted it to be organic to the title. I was looking at when I first started with Fantastic Four, Walt Simonson had just been on the book and had done some terrific science fiction stories. Really a lot of fun science fiction stories. Walt is Walt. I mean, I'm a Walt Simonson geek. I love his writing. I love his artwork. You know, what can I tell you? But for one reason or another, sales had kind of fallen off on the newsstand. And I thought, you know what? You got to get back to the soap opera aspects of the Fantastic Four and really work on the soap opera. And, Paul Ryan and I were just knocking our heads together trying to figure out, you know, how do we change the dynamics of the Fantastic Four and this and that? And I kept saying, well, you know, as long as Reed is in charge, it's going to just follow a certain pathway. And thought, you know what? What if Sue is in charge? How do you get Sue in charge if Reed's there? And the answer is, got to get rid of Reed. So we, you know, came up with this idea that, you know, Reed and Doom, you know, finally have to come together, and Doom, as is his way, feels that, you know, he's about to die, but he ain't going alone. and you know, they both apparently zap out but of course there were no bodies. And then with the very next issue, Sue's reaction is, of course they're still alive. They're not dead, they're still alive. So I had somebody, in the comic book constantly saying, they're still alive, they're out there somewhere. And I had Sue constantly searching for Reed, up until issue 400. Because everybody assumed that in issue 400, Reed was back. I remember looking at all the readers, reviewers and everybody. Everybody, 400's coming. That's when Reed's coming back. 400, Reed's coming back. I thought, you don't bring him back at 400. You bring him back at 404. So some number where nobody is expecting it from. And in issue 400, she finally accepted the fact that Reed was gone. Finally had our memorial service and that sort of stuff. But as soon as we had that, the plan, my original plan was I was going to give up writing Fantastic Four around 398, 399, and have the new team come on with 400. And then let them bring Reed back around, as soon as they wanted to. Things changed. By the time that came around, I was no longer editor in chief, and I signed a writing contract, which basically said Marvel could put me on whatever title they wanted. And I said, "Well, the plan was for me to get off Fantastic Four," and they said, "No, you're not going anywhere. You're staying on Fantastic Four." we had. But from the start, I knew how Reed and Doom came back. But I figured, we're going to go around and we're going to try a whole bunch of crazy storylines. And when the time comes to bring him back, I'll show the new team my plan. They can use that, or they can come up with their own idea, whatever the heck they want to do. Again, I'm blathering. I don't know if I've answered your question or not.
How completely? One of the things that I did absolutely love about it was Sue. Like, she became the absolute anchor of the book, and I thought that was really fantastic, for lack of a better word, because she was a character that you didn't really see enough of standing up, I thought. But I guess the real comment that I want to make is Paul Ryan. I mean, his work was fantastic, and I just noticed that.
I'm just going to say sexiest Sue Storm ever, or Sue Richards, or whatever. Sexiest invisible woman ever, Paul Ryan.
But I definitely noticed that on so much of your work, you include the artist as, often they'll get top billing, because it's always, plot, art, plot, script, and just kind of a bundle together. And I certainly noticed that with Paul Ryan.
Well, the artwork is such an intimate part of the whole process that I have always felt that I'm writing on the artist's coattails. So Ron Frenz, Paul Ryan, Ron Lim, Herb Trimpe, all the guys that I've exploited over the years. Pat Olive. I just wanted to share the credit and stuff. I'm not a big person for, credits things. I used to tell everybody, which are your ideas and which are Paul's ideas? And I said, the ideas you like all came from Paul, and the ones you didn't like all come from me. Same thing with Ron. Although, a lot of times with Ron Frenz, he comes up with all the ideas, and I'm just, that's it. That sounds good.
Here's one that's, I'm just going to throw it out there. In no way had I planned this question. But see any of those Fantastic Four movies? What'd you think?
No. Sadly, the only one I actually worked on was the John Carpenter one, which I don't know if you guys have seen that one.
You mean Roger Corman?
The Roger
Corman. Roger Corman,
yes,
of course. Yeah.
Still my favorite Fantastic Four movie
of the, yes.
of the ones made.
Well, it's certainly the funniest, but just one, you know, the budget on that film was $1 million.
Wow.
And around that same period, an hour episode of L.A. Law cost $1.5 million.
Wow.
Just to put it into perspective. The first Fantastic Four, you know, movie with the, you know, Jessica Alba and crew, I thought they had the characterization right. The origin was kind of hinky. The battle with Dr. Doom, there were some nice moments, but overall it didn't quite work. The Fantastic Four with the Silver Surfer, for the longest time I thought that was the best superhero movie I had ever seen. I thought that the battle with the Silver Surfer, the battle with Doom later on, that sort of stuff, terrific stuff. And there was a lot of just great character moments in that. So I really liked that second one. I know for some reason a lot of fans did not like that. But, you know, I'm sorry. I thought Jessica Alba did a great job. I thought I'm blanking on the guy who played Reed Richards. I thought he did a great job. I thought, you know, the four principals, they all did fantastic jobs. And I, you know, and I love this, the one with the Silver Surfer. The new one that just came out was a very interesting movie, but it had nothing to do with the Fantastic Four. And my biggest problem with it is I saw the end of the film. I know they defeated Doom. I have no idea how the heck they defeated Doom. I just don't quite understand what the heck happened. It you know, it read like, you know, every once in a while there are comic book scripts where, you know, at the end something happens, but you don't know exactly what, but you know the story is over. And that was my problem with that Fantastic Four, you know, the end of exactly what the heck they did. You know, I liked a lot of the spirit of that film. It just didn't quite come together. I know Marvel now has the rights to the Fantastic Four. I think they wanted the rights more for Doctor Doom than the FF. I think the problem with the FF these days is people just don't, they just, you know, don't understand that this is all about these four characters and, you know, and their soap operatic life. I think everybody's trying to do the next great science fiction novel, when really it's a family drama, emphasis on drama. I always think of Fantastic Four. There's an old TV show, I don't know if you remember, called Dallas. You know, Fantastic Four is Dallas set in outer space. You know, or on some fantastic landscape, but it's the family drama that's the important part of that. And I think, you know, these days people aren't that interested in the family drama, or, you know, the creative people aren't that interested. I think the readers will always be interested because I look at, you know, most novels out there and most television and everything else, and it's all the drama. So that soap opera stuff is still working everywhere except comics, which has walked away from it.
I would totally watch Larry Hagman as Doom.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Yeah, yeah. Especially now that he's passed away just recently. That would be something else. So I'm going to go back to the conventions now, because we had Steve Englehart on here about 3 weeks ago. And he admitted that there had been some hard feelings he had for you from when you removed him from West Coast Avengers many years ago, until he spent some time with you at the convention, and that helped to, and then he's able to let that go. Is that something you kind of find about conventions? Maybe you're thrown together with people you haven't seen for a while, and it's good for the soul.
I think it is good for the soul. And I think that it's important, you know, for us guys to, you know, remember that, you know, what happened in the past is the past. You know, I know Steve was upset about being removed from West Coast Avengers. It doesn't matter now, but I was not the guy who removed him from the title. I happened to be the editor in chief at that time. The editor, was the one who made that decision. And in point of fact, the editor had come to me and was talking to me about taking Steve off. And I thought I convinced him to give Steve another chance. Didn't even find out about the fact that Steve had been removed until I think a week later. I had to pick up a copy of the buyer's guide, and the headline was "The Falco Fires Engelhard." Oh, okay. And I went to the editor and said, "Did I fire Steve Engelhart?" that stuff was, in the past. As editor in chief, I felt that what my job was to empower the editors, to give them, control over their creative teams and their storylines and stuff. If something wasn't working, if sales were not working, if sales were heading in a downward trend, then I would step in. But otherwise, I stayed away from titles. I realized, I never took Bob Harris out to lunch because the X-Men titles were selling so well that I almost spent almost no time ever with Bob Harris. What can I tell you?
Is there some other people? I mean, it's just misunderstandings. It's just business, right? There's misunderstandings. Is there some other people you think, man, it'd be good to attend a convention if that person was there and just kind of talk things out? Or is there any other people that you have met and you just talked it out and it was good?
Yeah, a couple of people. I think that, as the editor in chief, I walked around with a big target on my chest, and that was my job, to have that big target on my chest and to be the focus when anybody was pissed at Marvel. I just kind of, took it for granted. So if anybody ever got fired or whatever, they just assumed it was me. I can't tell you how many times back in the day I would be walking, through a convention and somebody would come up to me and say, "Listen, I'm really sorry about this whole incident. I hope we can get past it." And I'd say, "Sure, sure, no problem." And we'd shake hands and walk away. And then I'd turn to Mark Ruffalo and say, "Who the hell is that?" and Mark would say to me, if you knew the name, he'd tell me the name. And otherwise he'd say, "Yeah, I have no idea." I said, "Do you have any idea what he's talking about?" "No." "Oh, well." And then we just keep on walking. And we used to get this on a regular basis that, I remember one time I ran into a guy and he's saying, "Listen, for years you and I have had problems." And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't even know who you are." and he told me who he was, and I said, "I'm sorry, I do not recognize the name." And he said to me, "Well, I wrote this horrible review about your work, and once that review came out, I just couldn't get any writing work for Marvel." I said, "Really? You wrote a horrible review about my work, and as a result, you couldn't get any work from Marvel?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "How much work were you doing for Marvel before you wrote the review?" He said, "Well, nothing." I said, "So nothing changed after the review?" "Yeah, but I always thought it was because of the review." And I said, "Well, what publication was it in?" He said, "I'm sorry, I never even heard of that publication either." And he says, "You really don't remember this review?" "No. I don't remember the review. I don't even remember the publication. I never heard of the publication. Never heard of you. I'm sorry that, maybe you just didn't get work from Marvel because, nobody liked your work. I said, I don't know what to tell you. So he gave me a couple of, you know, samples, and I looked at it and read them and said, yeah, I can tell you why you didn't get work.
Wow.
And then I sat down with him and told him what he had to do to get work. You know, in terms of, you know, stories have to have beginning, middles, and ends, and things like that. it's funny when you know, bad reviews and that sort of stuff. My experience with bad reviews is every once in a while, some magazine would rip me apart, and this is my memory of how this stuff would happen. Is Larry Hama would come in, sit on the couch in my office, and start reading the review. And boy, did they make fun of you! Tom DeFalco is the worst writer in Chris. And Larry, you guys interviewed Larry, you know he's got this infectious laugh. And my memory of all bad reviews and stuff is Larry Hama laughing and me sitting there like a fool laughing too. So the two of us would be laughing hysterically, over these reviews or whatever, you know, thing they were blaming me for that, you know, at that point. So, I just have fond memories of bad reviews. It's a strange thing. I think that over the years, I think, you know, people have misread a lot of situations. I think in this industry, especially this industry, we are trained to see everything in terms of a hero and a villain. All right, there's the heroic hero, and then there's the big powerful evil villain. So in a fight between a freelancer, you know, and Marvel, guess who gets cast as the villain? that came with the job.
Well, and you were also the editor-in-chief during one of the more tumultuous periods in Marvel's history. I mean, there's a lot of talk, especially in Marvel, the untold story about you know, the owners and the oversight over top of you constantly kind of butting in and making you change decisions. Now, how much did you get blamed for that, or how much was completely out of your hands even?
Well, a lot of that, the problem was that I wouldn't back down and I wouldn't change the decisions. That's why, eventually they decided that it was time to pull the plug on my promising career as an editor in chief. The truth was I was a stubborn son of a bitch. So I would, look at them and smile and say, no, we're not going to do that. No, I'm sorry. We're not going to do that. I always remember one time they had this great idea. They were going to sell an ad where they were going to basically put a stripe across the cover. I think it was a 2-inch stripe across, diagonal from one end of the cover to the other, selling something. I had a big fight with the salesperson, and I kept saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to sell an ad on our front covers because our covers are an ad. They're an ad saying, buy this book. So we're not going to do that. And, we ended up having to go to the president of the company and I said, ain't going to happen. Not while I'm editor in chief. He said, well, we could fix that. I said, well, if you fix that, then it's not my problem anymore. But as long as I'm editor in chief, it ain't happening. I guess I said that too many times. Who said for me?
Well, what do you get blamed for, and what do you think you don't get enough credit for your time as editor in chief?
Yeah, I don't know. To be honest, I don't. I haven't kept track of that stuff, and I know that the thing that I'm most proudest of as editor in chief was the Marvel Masterworks. I at the time I came up with that idea, I thought it was cool, and I still think it's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love that, you know, all the publishers are doing those sort of, you know, masterwork type books these days. So I get to buy a lot of Golden Age stuff a lot cheaper than I would have had to. Aside from that, I have no idea what I get credit for, or, you know, what I get blamed for.
Well, what would you like people to see as your legacy? Is it as a writer? Is it as an editor in chief? Is something else? Is it for starting the digest for Archie? What would you like to see people just kind of remember Tom DeFalco for?
I don't want anybody to remember me. I want them to see me still here in the pod. I want them to keep buying my stuff, my new stuff. I mean, what are you?
About 100 years from now. Yeah.
I'm hoping to still be around typing 100 years from now.
You're going to be like a Herbie Brain kind of like Reed from Spice.
As long as I can keep on doing it, guys. I'm like I say, I know I've cut down to 5 days a week, but it's still 5 days. I guess because of the gray hair and stuff, everybody asks me, you know, what about your legacy? I'm thinking, legacy? What the hell do I know about legacy? Things like legacy and style are things that I think you guys have to come up with. You know, you guys figure out what my legacy are. You guys figure out what my style is. You guys figure that sort of stuff out. Me, my job is just to make sure that I keep crafting stories that you care about. And, and I always look at it as one story at a time, whichever one I'm involved in, you know, that's the most important story of my life right now. And that's what I'm concerned about. What happens afterwards? Guys, really, I'm going to be around, so I don't really care.
Awesome.
Afterwards you guys can think of me as the biggest bum or whatever.
I'm hoping 100 years from now still be reading what you're typing. So, I mean, we got the same basic goal here.
Keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Maybe I should have a little less pizza, but that's probably not going to happen.
You should never have a little less pizza.
No, I agree. And I haven't even had New York pizza, which I'm sure is the best. You know,
no question about it. You poor deprived guy. I sometimes forget that most of the world has not experienced the wonderful joy that is New York pizza. But then again, it's probably better for you that you don't come into New York, you don't try it, and then be denied it for the rest of your life.
I'd have to move there is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. If we can go back to a couple more of the characters. So go back to the Sandman again, there's a character who, like I say, you kind of redefined, and then he becomes this hero, and then eventually just kind of gets recast as a villain, or Phil Urich, who I guess Terry Cavanaugh originally introduced him, but you turned him into the Green Goblin, and he's a hero, and then kind of because he has a couple crushes on women and it doesn't work out, he becomes a villain. Like it just seems like that's how it comes across to me. And I see these characters. Like, how difficult is it for you to see characters where you kind of have built up an ability to them to be turned back into what they were, turned into almost to me it's the lowest common denominator storytelling. Quite frankly, I'm probably more hard on it than you necessarily are. But it's just okay. Now they're a villain. It almost seems to be spitting in the face of what you did.
To be honest, I don't pay that much attention to this stuff. When I was, when I'm dealing with a character, I devote heart and soul into the character. And, you know, I know that these are not my characters, so that when the time comes that, that it's up to somebody else to determine their destiny, I just, you know, if I think a story will upset me, then I don't read it. You know, so, you know, I can very honest, you know, people ask me, so what do you think about Spider-Man selling his soul to the devil? Yeah, I never read it, so I have no real opinion on it because I haven't read it. Now, it could be a great idea, could be a great story, could be a terrible idea, could be a terrible story. I honestly don't know because I haven't read it. The Phil York stuff, I haven't read. You know, I did read some of the Sandman stuff, and I thought, you know, I thought it was done in a very sloppy way. Just decided, you know, hey, wakes up one morning and he's a villain. Forgot everything. And to me, you know, why did you do that? And the answer really was, you know, because that's how it was when I was a kid. And, okay, so a lot of people want to do things. They keep wanting to turn back the clock. And I always think that, you know, it's our job to constantly move forward, and turning back the clock is really a waste of time.
It's good that you can do that, though, because I know not every creator can do that. And Roger Stern, obviously, with the Hobgoblin storyline, could not just let it go and say it's somebody else's character, you know. So that's a good thing.
I know. At one point, Roger, when I was editor-in-chief, Roger called me up and he told me he wanted to do the Hobgoblin and Lip storyline. He described it to me. I said, Roger, I love the storyline, but it's too late. Forget about it. We have to move on with our lives. And then, Roger then, you know, held on to the story. And I think 10 years later, managed to convince somebody to do it. And I, you know, you can be the judge on whether or not it worked or didn't.
It didn't, but that's just me. But, you know, again, that's just me. Again, it fell flat, unfortunately, to me.
Because it didn't matter anymore. It was 15, 20 years out of date by the time.
By the time the reveal happened, I had forgotten who that character was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the problem.
Yeah.
You know, and it was based on one line of dialogue. You know, one line of dialogue too late in the series to really have an effect on it.
I'm very intrigued because you really got a chance to almost have like a character do-over and, you know, play in your own little sandbox with the MU2 universe. Because, I mean, you brought back a lot of your older characters, and that is a place where Phil Urich was able to be, you know, a hero again.
Yeah. The MC2 universe was really an unexpected gift. It was, you know... You know, at that time, I was assigned to be the writer of What If. And I was trying to come up with What If ideas. And, you know, what if Spider-Man had a spider, you know, girl? That was just an issue of What If. And Ron Frenz just seemed to be the perfect guy to draw that. He was drawing Superman at the time. And, you know, and I said, hey, come on, Ron, we'll just do one issue together. And he goes, I said, oh, okay, I can do one issue. And we did the one issue, and I remember as we got to the end, we had such a good time doing it. He said to me, you think we can ever do a sequel to this? I said, I don't know, it's a what if. You know, I think they've done sequels. Maybe a year from now or something, we can do another one. And then, to my surprise, a couple of months later, after the book came out, you know, Bob Harris came to me and said, hey, you know, we're thinking about doing a series on that Spider-Girl. And I thought, what are you, crazy? Who's going to buy a series based on a what if in a universe all by itself? And they had this goofy idea they're going to do three titles, put them in a bag, and sell them in Walmarts, which is why we did three titles. And, you know, they gave me the opportunity to create my own universe. And boy, did I have a good time with that. And it lasted 13 years.
I think there was a perception wrongly, obviously, from the fans that, oh, he's being removed of editor-in-chief, so as a reward for his service, we'll give him his own universe and let him play off in his own little thing just to, you know, because we feel guilty about removing him. That's not obviously it at all, but that was kind of the perception that people had. And but was there a hope for you that it's like, okay, maybe I can start off creating this, but eventually maybe we can add characters and add books and I can kind of become the editor-in-chief of this whole new universe and expand it to 20 titles or something?
No.
No?
No. When we first did it, they said, you know, we want the six issues of, you know, we want three titles, six issues of each. You think you can do that? I thought, yeah. It's just 6 months, you know, 6 months of intense work. I can put that in. Yeah, sure. And then as we, you know, got towards the, you know, the sixth issue, they said, you know what, the Walmart deal hasn't come together yet. You think you could do six more of each of the titles? I said, what do you mean, six additional issues? Yeah, I guess so. We can do that. And then they asked for, you know, another year, you know, and said, but we want two different titles and we want to continue one of the titles. And, you know, can you do that? And I go, yeah, I guess.
you're offering to pay me to write. I guess I can do that.
And Spider-Girl was supposed to end with issue 16. And they said, listen, we'd like you to do one more issue. Can you stretch it to 17 and make 17 a double size issue? And that'll be the last issue. Okay. All right. Sure. And then as we got towards 17, they said, you know what? Maybe six more Spider-Girl. And they kept saying, you know, maybe six more. Maybe six more. And that went on for 13 years. So, no, I was not planning on becoming editor-in-chief of a bunch of titles and that sort of stuff. I kept thinking, okay, I got, you know, six more issues to go, and then I'm fired. And then I gotta go out and get a real job.
Were you ever offered a editor-in-chief with another company after the Marvel, or would you have ever considered it? Would you consider it?
Editor-in-chief? If no.
No?
No.
Been there, done that.
I can tell you that being editor-in-chief was not a lot of fun. It's a lot more work than people can imagine, a lot more stress. You know, I got to do it at a time when I had, you know, two great bosses. The publisher was a gentleman by the name of Mike Hobson, who is just a terrific gentleman, terrific publisher. He handled, you know, all of the contracts, all of the publishing things. You know, he and I made a good team. I handled the creative. He handled the administrative, and we were a great team. A lot of our success was based on him. And then the president of the company, a gentleman by the name of Jim Galton, who, you know, was a businessman, and yet he understood the creative, you know, the creative mentality, and allowed me to be the lunatic that I am. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, I say, yeah, I think I want to do a title that does this. And go, what? And I'd say, yeah, I think it could work. I think if we, you know, Ghost Rider, I think we do Ghost Rider again, but try to make it, you know, modernize it a little bit, but, you know, and Ghost Rider. Well, you're the creative guy. Do you think you can make it work? Go for it. And, you know, and a lot of those gambles paid off. So I was, you know, just in a great position. And I don't, and those two great bosses really spoiled me. Over the years, I've, had many opportunities to work for a number of different companies, and most of the times I would look at the people that I'd be reporting to and think, nah, this is not going to work. A number of times people have come to me and asked me if I'd be interested in being a publisher for this set of publications or for that publication or that sort of thing. But, I'm a creative guy. I'm not really the publisher type. I, have to go out and buy an actual suit. I wouldn't be able to wear sneakers to the office. So I don't think I'm really the publishing type. I have over the years, every once in a while, thought I'd love to get back to editing because there's just something wonderful about being an editor. But I'm not, I don't think anybody will ever hire me to be an editor again because they'd be afraid that I'd be looking for their job. But, looking to move up the ladder and become the next editor in chief or publisher or that sort of thing. Where, most of the time when I look at my, people who are editor in chiefs now, and all I feel for them is great sympathy. I'm very happy being I refer to myself as a typewriter jockey, even though I haven't touched an actual typewriter in 25 plus years. But I still think of myself as a typewriter jockey because that's how I started on a good old typewriter.
So was it almost like a weight off of your chest then when you stopped being editor in chief and just went back to just being a freelance writer?
Oh yeah, yeah. I remember when they said to me the company decided they were going to move me into another position, and I said thank you, I appreciate the offer, but I think it's. They didn't want me to be editor in chief anymore. They wanted me to do something else. And I said, I think I'm going to go back to full-time writing. I remember, at one point the president, who was a different president then, said to me, well, I don't know if we can still use you. And I said, don't worry about it. I'm shook. I'm sure I'll be fine. and the next day they came up with a writing contract for me. I think that was not to reward me, but, to keep me from going to DC or Image or something like that. I'm just lucky. I'm a very lucky guy. I get to create worlds, some very fantastic, some very mundane, and, create fiction and dive into all sorts of people's heads and just have a grand old time for myself. And I know that there are enough, readers out there that are happy with the material that they, they're keeping me busy. So,
how about from your perspective, kind of the final days of Jim Shooter's regime and then the first days of yours, how did you see that kind of going down? It sounds almost like the way it's portrayed, like there was just, that was, they had no choice. The staff was revolting against Jim. I don't know if that's correctly portrayed. I think that is kind of the story that's out there.
Well, the story is that the staff and the freelancers were revolting against Jim. And I think, some people say that's what it was. And some people say, no, it wasn't. I felt that as those days were coming to a head, that the company was going to have to make a change. And since I was second in command, I always assumed that they were going to get rid of Shooter and they were going to get rid of me. And in point of fact, I was, at the time they got rid of Shooter, I was deeply in negotiations to move to the West Coast. I planned to give up comic books and move worked for an animation studio, and I was negotiating my final contract at the time they made the switch, and had even tried to convince Shooter to come with me to the West Coast, because I just always assumed, hey, I'm second in command. They're going to throw out Shooter, they're going to throw out me, and they're going to put Grunewald in charge. And I just took that as a, as an assumption as what was going to happen. And when they told me that they were going to get rid of Shooter and put me in charge, I was very taken aback and tried to talk them into, into going in a different direction.
Do you think it was these times were also weighing heavily on Jim Shooter, and it was the same thing? It was a release for him too, or
I don't know, because Jim and I never really discussed how it felt afterwards. So I really don't know how he felt. And I'm not the guy he'd be confiding into, because he probably looked at me as trying to to steal his job, or whatever.
Do you think it was fair, kind of the way he's perceived by both the staff and also by the comic community, the readers? Do you think there's just a perception that he's a control freak, and that he's, do you think that this is all fair, or do you think he's a much more complicated man than people give him credit for?
I think we're all much more complicated people than anybody gives us credit for. I think, Jim Shooter, was really, is one of the best plot doctors I have ever seen in motion. And I've seen some great plot doctors. Emotion. He could, pull the gem out of a writer would come in blathering for 20 minutes, and Jim would pull the gem out of his story nonsense and say, this is what you should build your story on. And I was always in awe of Jim's plotting ability, and he was just a great idea man. Came up with some tremendous ideas. I think that Jim and I were a good team, because he'd come up with great theories, and I would be able to figure out how to put this stuff into practice. I was much more, practical, and could deal with the staff a little bit better than Jim could. I don't want to, say anything negative, because Jim taught me a lot and was very good. I'm not sure how Jim is perceived. I think that the fans of Jim Shooter, I think he was wrongly terminated. The people who don't like Jim, are glad that he was terminated. And, it pays your money. You make your own choices. Everybody gets to make their own decision in comics.
Well, it's interesting because, Jim isn't out there as much. You at least have started showing up to conventions again. But, we don't really see Jim Shooter out anywhere. So he's almost become this mythical figure of comic books. And we don't hear his side of the story very much.
Well, and if you hear it, you'll either believe it or you won't. And, when you hear my side of the story, you'll either believe it or you won't.
Oh, we won't.
And nor should you. You should take anybody. Everybody has their own prejudices, their own, point of view, their own way of looking at things. Just because it's in the newspapers doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah, the three sides of the story, yours, mine, and the truth, right?
Well, that kind of brings. Oh, go ahead, please.
I was going to say, I used to say that you ask five editors a yes or no question, then you're going to get five different answers.
On yes or no?
Trust me, I've done that. you know, yes or no. And I would get five different answers. Because editors see the, you know, the shades of gray.
Yes, please. This brings me back to something. I'm not sure if you've had any in conventions or any other places, if you've run into Priest, Christopher Priest, James Owsley, Jim Owsley, whatever his name is right now. Yeah. But because he was the editor towards the end of your run on Amazing Spider-Man. And so have you, when's the last time you saw or talked to him?
The last time I spoke to him was a bunch of years ago. He had written this, you know, Why I Never Speak About Spider-Man thing. And naturally, everybody in creation sent me a copy of it. I looked it over and said, this is the most ridiculous, self-serving piece of bullshit I have read in years. And I called him up and I said, you are so full of shit. And he said to me, well, you know, this was my perception and this, and I said, don't give me that crap. You're full of shit. And he and I just, you know, yelled at each other for a few minutes. And then he said, all right, I'll make some revisions. And he made some stupid revisions. And I looked at him and said, nah, he's still full of shit. So
I was, it's fun. I have here, clips of it. I wasn't sure if you had read it or were aware of it.
And years ago.
I was wondering if I could read some to you and then you could tell me whether or not you see the perspective of being the same. It's just some of the clips. The thing's freaking huge. So it's not all of it, but would you mind if we do that?
Okay, sure.
Brett, what do you read? You're a better reader than I am.
Which one do you want to
start right there?
Oh, the coming from the Mort Weisinger school of screw them if they can't take the heat. Shooter was a kinder, gentler, smarter, more touchy-feely version of his mentor, the legendary East DC editor who kicked ass and took names and built a solid reputation for making the trades run on time. Jim made deals and threw money at people who couldn't stand him. He routinely bought big-ticket Christmas presents for staffers he knew were plotting behind his back. He didn't care about being the heavy. Somebody had to be the heavy.
Would you consider this to be true?
Everything except the staffers who were plotting behind his back. You know, Marvel wasn't that kind of place. I mean, you know, Marvel was the kind of place where you had to worry about somebody putting a water balloon on your door, a tax on your chair. But nobody wanted anybody else's job, and nobody was plotting against them, you know. You know, they might stick a banana peel under your door, but, you know, that was the extent of the kind of plotting. So, you know Owsley makes it sound like it was, you know, much more of a, you know, political thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in here about how he was too young and he definitely shouldn't have been, you know, put in that position and that kind of thing. And you know, so he definitely speaks of you two leaving on bad terms and how he regrets that.
Read the next quote here.
Well, if I had to do it over again, I never would have accepted the appointment as editor of the Spider-Man franchise. I made a lot of mistakes. I hurt a lot of people. I lost a lot of friends. It's a difficult thing for me to discuss. We'd all like to be heroes of our own stories, and it's hard to tell the story of when you were a chimp. I spent 2.5 years of my life being an incredible chimp, paralyzed by my own chimpness and chimposity, which is a great word, I might add, but and wholly convinced that if I lost my job at Marvel, the world would end. Well, I did, and it didn't. And now, nearly 2 decades later, I have some maturity and experience under my belt. Not that I'm any less of a chimp at 40 than I was at 22, but I have the perspective and, yes, the wisdom now to be horrified by the choices I made.
Yeah, that's true.
That part's true.
You know, and he should be horrified by the choices he made.
All right, Brett, keep going.
How much of this are we going to read?
The whole thing!
No, we're not reading.
Yeah, all right, we are. Here we go, I'll do it. Jim Shooter was not a villain. People like to paint him as a villain, but that speaks more to the good versus evil mindset of people in our business. Shooter was a genius. And Shooter was and is a genius. It is difficult to dispute that. The man had a brilliant mind and ultimately the heart of a Boy Scout. If people got hurt by Jim, it was largely because Jim's greatest flaw is his inability to communicate with us non-genius types. Jim is a guy who always beans several laps around the track ahead of us, and, like most truly gifted folks, his people skills sucked. I think you've said something along those lines. The rapid and massive expansion and explosion in sales and profits at Marvel under editor-in-chief Tom DeFalco were unquestionably the fruits of Shooter's labor and the harvest of his hard of the hard work and bloodletting of Shooter's tumultuous turn as Marvel editor-in-chief, which is to take nothing away from Tom, who was savvy enough to know how to move the market with the market and not cut off his own nose to spite Shooter's face, but made the deals that needed to be made and made the calls that maximized Marvel's advantage. To DeFalco's credit, he didn't step on Marvel's and industry's chances to expand the market by a modest guess of at least fivefold, just to play office politics and distance himself from his predecessor. Tom saw that the harvest of Shooter's seeding, and rather than get lost in resentment for Jim, he did what was best for Marvel, which takes nothing away from Tom while also pointing out the enormous gains Marvel made as a company thanks to Jim Shooter. How do you feel about it?
I think I understand what he's saying, but I disagree with the basic premise of it. I think that Jim and I had a different philosophy about publishing. Jim felt that, you know, quality was based on the number of titles that you did. And Jim's idea was in order to, for Marvel to be the most quality filled titles, you had to cut down the number of titles. So Jim's philosophy was shrink the number of titles and the remaining titles would have greater quality. You know, I always thought that quality was a percentage of the number of titles that you did. And I cannot give you, you know, it's not like I worked out, you know, a number. Let's say that, you know, for, you know, argument's sake, that the percentage of titles that you do is 20% suck. So if you did 10 titles, 20% suck. So that meant if you did 10 titles, 8 were good and 2 sucked. If you did 20 titles, you know, 16 were good and 4 sucked. If you did 100 titles, 80 were good and 20 sucked. And I thought that with publishing, it was our job to, you know, I always said the secret of publishing is you actually have to publish. So you have to keep expanding and keep trying things and keep throwing things up against the wall and keep experimenting and trying different things and just, you know, growing. And yes, as you grew, the number of titles that you did that, you know, sucked would grow. But so would the number of quality titles, that, you know, the quality and everything else that, you know, that it would always roughly be, you know, 80% were good and 20% sucked, no matter how many you did. So, but our job was constantly to move forward and to grow. So Jim and I had two different philosophies. I think our expansion of sales and volume and all that other stuff came because they started following my philosophy as opposed to Shooter's philosophy. So I disagree with Owsley's premise. You know, did Jim do a lot for the industry? Absolutely. Did he do a lot to make freelancers' lives better? Absolutely. But on the other hand, I think that if we had cut down, at one point you wanted to cut down to 40 titles or 20 titles, I don't think that would have done anybody any good. And I think that...
I remember hearing 2 a week was the plan.
What?
I remember hearing 2 a week was the plan.
Yeah. I think that if Marvel had cut down to 2 titles a week, it would have been out of business. Because in those days, the whole company rested on the profits of publishing. And if you were doing 2 titles a week, I'm sorry. It would not have supported an editorial staff, would not have supported the company, and the company would have gone out of business. Now, one of the things I did do is I spent a lot of time with licensing. I spent a lot of time with the animation studio. I spent a lot of time with all the other factions of the company because I was a desperate man. And I wanted those factions to be making money because I thought as soon as they started making money, it was less pressure on my back.
Yeah.
The only income the company was really making was from publishing. I laughed years later when they were talking about, I think, during the Bill Gemmis range, publishing has made money for the first time in its history. And I thought, really? what happened before there was any licensing or anything else like that? During the 80s and the 90s, we couldn't give away licenses. We couldn't give away licenses. Now, I think 90% of Marvel's money comes from licensing. in my day, the Secret Wars toy license was the biggest license we had ever sold. And then Mattel decided not to do it because it wasn't big enough. After the second year.
I'm going to paraphrase a little more of this because it is probably too much, and we've taken an awful lot of your time here. But basically, he says that Jim Shooter was always on him to make the Spider-Man books better, and that the advantage Shooter had when he was grinding his people was as editor-in-chief, he could do so, and everyone knew it, but he didn't have that power as he was simply just an editor. That he did say that he considered the Amazing Spider-Man to be the crown jewel, and he really enjoyed the run. he said that one of the things that he had an issue with was this, though. He said he had an issue with the flat head of Peter, and he called Ron Frenz at one point, blaming him or asking him to stop making his head so flat, and that you went in and gave him a piece of advice, and he said, all I said to Ron was, please stop making Peter's head so flat, and you explained to him that a freelancer sitting in Auschwitz somewhere is very vulnerable and nearly always paranoid. And told him, and he said, I said, please stop making Peter's head flat. And you said, told him that Ron likely heard, I hate you and hate what you do. Is this conversation sound at all familiar to you?
It sounds like something I would have said because I having been a freelancer, I was, talking to Owsley and saying, when you talk to freelancers, you've got to schmooze them. You've got to get them on your side. And just to call up out of the blue and just start criticizing them, not a good way of doing it. You've got to talk to them and stuff. And I also didn't know what the heck he was talking about a flat head. But,
Yeah.
But.
Again, he goes on to say he was 23 years old. He's the office pariah. People are blaming him for Fink Roth leaving Webb because of what Shooter says. He said, around that time, Stan decided that Peter and Mary Jane would get married when the Spider-Man syndicated the newspaper strip. I thought and still think it was the worst creative move the company could have made. Spider-Man, by definition, is the hero who could be you. Once he marries a supermodel and becomes domesticated, it moves beyond the realm of wish fulfillment of most adolescents. I mean, sure, they'd like to give Mary Jane a toss, but marriage? What teenage boy dreams of marriage? It was creative suicide I could not tolerate. I told Jim and Tom the Spider-Man would get married in the comic series, and he said, this is a quote, over my dead body. Did he say those words to you guys?
I don't know, but, again, things that I take issue with. At the time we were doing it, Mary Jane was a runway model. And these are women who are being paid minimum wage to walk up and down, runway shows. that this is, you know, before super, I think supermodels were just coming out, and she was not a supermodel. She was a runway model who, you know, was trying to be an actress. So she was not making a lot of money. Number two, the plan in the comic books was that Peter was going to ask Mary Jane to be married, to get married, and she was going to leave him at the altar. They were never going to get married. That ended up getting changed after, you know, after I left the book. But I don't know, you know, what the heck over his dead body, which has a certain appeal to me, but that's neither here nor there. Like I say, I take issue with both of those things.
I had been told at least a dozen times to fire Tom. Tom was late. Tom was busy. Tom was distracted. And now Tom was not doing his best on Spider-Man. Inca Rubenstein quit, annoyed that DeFalco and friends were habitually erratic.
Again, I take issue with what he said, because what, you know, what Jim would do is he would give us, you know, our deadlines. His deadlines were very different from the official Marvel deadlines, in that his deadlines were 2 months ahead of the official Marvel deadlines. So he would give us deadlines for like the next two or three issues. Ron and I would work out a plan on which we would hit those deadlines. As we hit the deadlines, he would give us new deadlines, which showed us that we were now 2 months late again. You know, and since he was controlling the deadlines and keep changing deadlines on us, according to his schedule, we were late. According to the official Marvel book, when we were taken off the book, we were 8 months ahead. At one point the person in charge of the deadlines came and said, I heard Jim took you off of Spider-Man because you guys are late. And I said, that's his story. And she said, you guys are my prime example of what to be, because you're 8 months ahead of the deadlines. I said, well, according to Jim, we're late. And she said, he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, does he? we were so late that at one point he took two completed issues out, the Fire Lord issues, because he liked the story so much that he wanted to make it a graphic novel. So he took them out of sequence and put them on the side. And held them out of sequence for about 3 months. And then Shooter said, no, I don't think that should be a graphic novel, and then put them back in. And two issues suddenly materialized by us, which were completely done. And somehow, Ron and I were still 5 months late. We couldn't figure out how that stuff happened. So,
he says he came up with the idea of you doing Sensational Spider-Man, which is be like Spider-Man Unlimited, where you just occasionally do like every 3 months do it. That way you could keep doing it, but that he removed you. And he said you took the news very hard, and that it ended your friendship, that you had threatened to quit. Shooter apparently showed up at his door the next day, asked him why he'd let you go, and he stated to Tom, or should Jim Shooter, that he had cleared it with you or with him first. And you know, basically, what's your perspective of that?
Oh, I think Jim, you know, was mistaken. I like I said, You know, according to Jim, I threatened to quit over this. I have no memory of that, and told him, I'm not letting one editor decide what I'm doing with my life. This stuff is so old. What can I say? The guy was just trying to justify his existence. He fired me in May, came in, told me that in those days, in order to drop off a script, you had to make an appointment with him. Even though we were in the same office, I had to make an appointment to drop off a script to him. So that morning I came in, I made an appointment to drop off a script because I had a script written. I had half the script written in my briefcase. This was in May. He came in, he told me that, he didn't think I could meet deadlines anymore and this and that. He wanted to fire me. Put us on another book. I thanked him for the offer for the other book, told him not a chance in hell was I ever going to work for him again. And I said, fine, okay. And
did you consider yourselves friends before this all went down, like he does?
At one point we were friends, but by this point, no. Because he was just acting too crazy. And anyway, that issue, which was supposed to come out in October of that year, Jim ended up scripting it himself, and it missed shipping. So it arrived late.
That's very ironic.
Where if he had not interfered with it, it would have been done at the end of May. What he also fails to discuss is he disappeared from, he went away for a week vacation and never came back for about 2 months because he was dealing with some personal issues. And at that time, we didn't even know whether or not he ever was going to come back because we couldn't get in touch with him for 2 months. But the books were so far ahead that nobody got that upset about it.
Well, I appreciate your kind of giving your side on this. I mean, he ends it by apologizing. Profound regret and sincerest apologies to Ron Frenz, Danny Fingeroth, Al Milgram, Peter David, Mark Silvestri, Art Adams, and Tom DeFalco. And says that he doesn't consider Jim Shooter to be a bad guy. Despite the situation he's put in. I guess it's not so much important for you. Obviously, it doesn't sound like for you it's just the past. I think for people who just want to know your side, I think we'll probably appreciate hearing their side, though. So thank you very much for indulging me in that.
Well, there was an article about the Hobgoblin, the end of the Hobgoblin, which appeared in, Back Issue magazine or some magazine by Tomorrow's. In which people, excuse me a second.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes. Hello. I'm sorry.
Pizza's not here yet.
Yeah. There was a Back Issue magazine or Tomorrow's Thing or something where they interviewed a bunch of people about the Hobgoblin. And everybody's story is all the same except for Owsley's. I don't remember what that was, but it kind of lays out Owsley's story and shows how his perception of everything is very different from everybody else's.
I have one kind of out of the blue question. Now, Mo had commented to me about how you knew everybody in the industry, and so undoubtedly you would know how to pronounce their names. So
Yeah, there's so many people we have no idea how to pronounce their names.
I'm actually mostly interested. Fabian, I want to say Nicieza.
That's it.
All right,
Wow.
wow.
Holy
Great
crap.
work. Yeah.
Okay. Here's one that's always gotten me that seems a little Doug Munch? Munch?
Bench.
Minch.
Doug
Okay.
Bench.
Doug Minch. It seems so simple, and
Sienkiewicz.
yet. Yeah.
Bill Sienkiewicz is one that people often have
Sienkiewicz.
Yep.
Okay.
That's
You
right.
met, I think you said, I think JM, I always thought it was JM DeMatteis, and it's
Dematis. Dematis.
DeMatteis.
Nice.
There you
Nice.
go. See, all these, there's so many of these names. Why can't everybody just be Smith or DeFalco?
Yeah, there was never any question on your
I
name.
never asked about Paul Ryan. I was pretty sure I knew how to do that one.
Yep. Yeah, that was great. But well, Tom, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I just want to thank you for all of it and all the fantastic stories. I know I've had a great time, and I know Mo has had a great time.
Yeah, I had a great time. I don't want to tell you. I mean, it's an honor for me because you shaped my childhood, and in shaping my childhood, you shaped me as a human being, as an adult too. That's the influence I think that these comics have to those people who read them and read them voraciously. And so that means a lot to me. So thank you very much for that. And again, for indulging me in all my stupid questions.
The only question that's stupid are the ones that you don't ask. But thank you very much, sir. I really do appreciate it. Like I said, I had a great time, doing the stories, and it's very gratifying to know that they hit home.
Well,
Thank
they
you.
absolutely do, and we completely wish you all the best in the future.
Is there
And
anything you'd like people to check out? Do you have any? I don't know. I don't think you have any social media or those type of things, do you? Or anything you would like people to visit?
I have Facebook, but almost never use the thing, because I always feel bad pushing material, and some of it, is under my name, some of it's under other names that I, keep secret so that Marvel doesn't claim ownership of it. So I, I'm not a big promoter. I'm just, I just like to, sit in my room and write all day long.
Awesome. Well, maybe we'll get you back sometime and you'll tell us how Krish came to be. I believe it was that the name of the book
Ah, yes,
that
the
we
Superman.
wondered. I
Yeah.
read that going, how did this
All
even
right, well,
happen?
listen, I give you guys credit to even know that I worked on that.
I get Ron Frenz.
With
With
Ron
Ron,
French again. Yeah,
yes.
that's right.
Ron and I work on many a thing that most comic book fans have never heard of.
Well,
We're still working together and still having a great time together.
although Sam Hill was not Ron Frenz,
No,
so.
that was not. No.
Sam Hill was not. Again,
I called him Joe Hill
those
in the
guys.
interview, didn't I?
Yep.
I did call him Joe Hill. I was thinking of Joe Thumb for some reason. I don't know what's going on.
Did you guys read Sam Hill?
Oh yeah,
Yes,
you
I actually
bet.
really liked it.
Oh yeah. Like I say, it's a different style for you. And I love the noir take on it, the elements and the way it wraps up each individual chapter, but feels off to a whole story. It's great stuff.
I'm a sucker for the hard-boiled PI, though. So,
Yeah, great stuff. Was that Archie Comics that was published under?
the
That
red
was Archie
black circle.
Comics. I think
Is that creator owned?
No, it's not creator owned. That's Sam Hill was based on a character that they had published in the 50s by Harry Lucy.
Oh.
And great stuff. Great stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, let me promote Sam Hill, guys.
All right. Please
Well,
do.
that's right. I never even got to talk about the Mad Doctor Doom, the
Yeah, the
older
other
Doctor
Doctor
Doom.
Doom.
yeah,
Man from
from
Riverdale. I say
yeah,
we have done
Riverdale.
our research.
I've been privileged to be able to do a lot of different kinds of things, and I love them. I love them all.
So definitely check out Sam Hill, everybody.
That's right. That's right. We'll do the plugging for you.
All right.
Recommendation to go out and pick up anything with Tom DeFalco's name on it.
All
right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Best of luck in the future, and we'll talk to you again.
Talk to you again.